If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
From Wondery, I'm Matthew Scherr, and this is Over My Dead Body.
Baby, I'm guilty. I've got his blood on my hand.
Baby, you're crazy. I never touched that man.
Eric and I are continuing to follow the events and the upcoming trial and the murder of Dan Markell. Plus, I've had several people who knew Dan and Wendy reach out to me since this podcast first premiered. And we're expecting that some of the people who were unwilling to speak with us will open up more once the trial is concluded. So please subscribe wherever you're listening right now if you want to continue getting new episodes and updates on the case. We also have future seasons of Over My Dead Body in the works. More true stories of people pushed to the limits that are just as unbelievable as this story. Today, I want to open things up a bit. We've wrapped our first 6 episodes of season 1. Go back and listen if you haven't already. I've been getting a lot of questions about Dan and Wendy, where the story goes from here, and my reporting work in general. Questions from social media, from my friends, and from my colleagues. Speaking of which, I've got my colleague Rico Galliano here, who's going to talk this all out with me. Hey, Rico.
Hello, Matt.
Rico hosts a couple other shows at Wondery, namely a new show that just launched called One Plus One, that brings to life the stories of history's great creative partnerships, starting with John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Rico is also the co-host of the workplace advice show Safe for Work.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on and for giving such a nice intro of my show. Like apparently a lot of other people, I devoured your show in what felt like 10 seconds, so I'm honored to be here. Remind us, first of all, how did you come upon this case? Like, what was your first inkling of this in the world?
So I'd written a story for GQ magazine about a rabbi in New York, and this rabbi guy was essentially beating up. He would kidnap men from the Orthodox community and these men would be refusing to give their wives a divorce, to grant them a divorce, because that's how it works in certain parts of the Orthodox world. You know, after this came out in GQ, I remember the editors at GQ joking, like, that never has an Orthodox Jewish story ever appeared in GQ magazine. We are breaking all sorts of, all sorts of
boundaries. Not your typical cover story.
And that came out, and it did, I guess, people read it. It did fairly well. And after it had been out a little while, I got a phone call or an email initially from a guy who had known Dan Markell. And this guy said, hey, you know, Dan was working on this rabbi case when it was going down. And you should maybe look into Dan's murder because it could be connected. Now, at that time, you know, I didn't know much about Dan at all. But that's sort of how it got started for me. And at that point, the story was very small, right? It was, there was no one knew. Dan was dead. There were zero suspects. And it was, you know, it was clear it wasn't a robbery, but that was about it.
Yeah, pure mystery.
Yeah, no one knew what to make of it. And the papers in Tallahassee were covering it, but not many other people. So I started keeping an eye on it, and I have an Evernote, and I've got like a big file of, you know, I usually take like newspaper articles or something someone has told me, and, you know, hey, maybe this could be a magazine story at some point. So I dropped it in there, and then a couple years later, the arrests started happening, And I was like, it had been clear that it was really interesting, even if it had been just a famous law professor murdered in his driveway. But once it opened up in the way it did after the arrests, it was, you know, it was a whole different thing, right? It had a real draw to it. And so that's when I really started looking into it, initially as a magazine piece, in fact.
Well, tell me specifically what you're looking for in a story that this story finally had at that point. Like, what detail made you go, this true crime tale now in a world of probably way too many true crime tales is especially worth telling now?
Do you ever, you know, Calvin Trillin, he writes for The New Yorker?
Yeah, of course.
He wrote a book. I think it might be out of print, or maybe they've started reissuing it now. It's called Killings. And I guess Trillin, I'm not sure how much is unique to this book and how much was New Yorker articles that he'd written at the time, but it's an anthology of true crime magazine stories. And I think it's on the back cover of it, of the book, that they say this, or maybe Trillin says it himself, I can't remember. But it's basically the idea that a really good true crime story, a really effective one, is more about how a person lived, or it's about a culture. It's about a society that you didn't know that much about. So you can have a murder that is particularly violent, is particularly bizarre. But I think that the really good true crime stories, whether it's in documentary form or whether it's a podcast, or even if it's, you know, a scripted series of some sort, it's like the murder is not enough, right? It has to be a story about something that's much bigger. And what this case did have that ultimately. It might not have with just Dan, but even if it had been just Dan, it would have had that. You know, he lived in this world, this legal academic world that I just found so fascinating, and that he was a star in it. And you had the fact that this case spanned the entire state, right? I mean, we're used to making fun of Florida for having the most bizarre crimes, you know, Florida man, whatever. But this one really was, this was like all of Florida packed into one case, right? It was like the northern Florida, you know, the sort of jungly South Georgia, really hot Florida. And then it was the high society in Miami. And then it was the criminal underworld in Miami. And it brought all these worlds together in a really, really interesting way. And I just, you know, that was what I latched onto. And initially when I was thinking about it as a magazine story, I think that's sort of how I had it framed, that it was the meeting of these two worlds.
So, all right, you've decided this is a story you want to tell. This is a world you want to get involved in. Now you're invested in it. And now the hard part begins, actually reporting a story that is this insanely complicated. What is the hardest part about that? Like, specifically for this story, what was the hardest part about getting this story together?
I would say there were two main big challenges. One is a sort of double-edged sword kind of thing. Florida is very, it's a good state to be a journalist in, because Florida's sunshine laws are aggressively open, right?
I mean, you were just going to say, because there's so much to write about.
Well, there's that too, but then, you know, opposed to I live in Georgia, it's much harder to get files and audio and video related to a case. I used to live in New York. It was the same way there. Florida is very good. Their public officials are very good at making this kind of material available. Now, the flip side of that is we put in a public information request when we were, you know, right out of the bat, and we got back these hard drives, right, the terabyte hard drives, and they had a massive amount of information on them, interrogations, sure, you know, tapped phone calls. They had all the PDFs from the case. They had court transcripts. And it was just, it's endless, you know, and to be able to, you know, you're faced with that and you're like, wow, this is amazing. And then you're just thinking, how am I ever going to make it through all of this? And I think that we got lucky here because I had a reporting partner, Eric, and then we had the team at Wondery, too. And I want to give a big shout out to Chris Siegel, who was the associate producer on this project, and he was sort of the librarian of all these clips. But man, just so much. And even after you have them transcribed, you know, you've seen something. You're like, I know that didn't this person say this at some point, you know, in 2015? But who knows? Like, and even if you get the right search term in the transcript, you're going to come up with like 450 results. So that was really, really challenging. Another big challenge is And I found myself saying this a lot because I have gotten a lot of questions from other print people who say, you know, how did you find the experience? What was it like going into recording a podcast as opposed to writing it? And I feel that by far the biggest challenge is getting people on the record in the way that you need them on the record. So with magazine stories, I'm really used to being able to say, you know, sit down in like a noisy cafe, right? And or go to a bar, drink a beer, and have the only recording device be my iPhone. And people can say, that's off record, that's on background, and go back and forth and back and forth. And you know, that's how you build trust with people, right? That's how you get what you need. Mm-hmm. With the podcast thing, we would go in, sometimes Eric and I would talk to the people beforehand, but even then, when they sat down, I'm thinking really clearly about this one instance of a person that I won't name, where she had been very effusive, you know, I'm happy to tell you all of this stuff, and then the producer gets there, and the mic gets in her face, and she just shut down. She was just, you know, like literally shaking, because something about the microphone seems to reinforce that this is going to be held in perpetuity for, you know, it's never going to go away. So that's a challenge in a big way.
How did you find yourself, you know, easing people's fears and saying, you know, ignore this thing that's going to record what you say forever?
Yeah, it was a product of time, right? I think that in most cases, when we could get people to talk for more than an hour, eventually they forgot about the microphone.
Yep.
And I think, you know, Rob Adelson is a good example. He's Wendy Adelson's brother, estranged brother. And he, you know, he had never spoken to media before, never spoken to the press about this case. And he and his wife were rightly, you know, they had reservations, right? They would essentially be,
of course,
putting their voice to a podcast that didn't cast a very flattering light on their family. And I think that, you know, we had long conversations with them before, and then once the mic comes on, you know, there's a little bit of nervousness still, and you hope that it does melt away. And you also, I learned, thanks to the team at Wondery, how to ask the right questions in a way that would get the answers that you want, the kind of answers that are stories in of themselves rather than just yes or no, which is obviously much harder to use. So I was just talking about this with a friend. If I went back to do this whole process again, I feel like I'd be on much more sure footing. When we went into it, I had, you know, we had no idea what we were doing, and we were just writing it like it was a magazine story. And by the end, you know, we're starting to all get on the same page, but still have a lot to learn.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
Beyond the process of making a podcast or the process of putting together a complicated story, what was maybe the hardest element of this story to crack, or the hardest fact to verify, or something like that?
Well, I think over this entire case hangs a really one very big question, right? Which is that if you believe, like prosecutors do, that the Adelsons had a role, or let's say Charlie Adelson had a role in the death of Dan Markell, the big question that you're then led to is how much did the rest of the family know, right? You know, again, this is allegedly. Charlie's never been arrested. He's never been indicted. You know, there's a probable cause affidavit written out for him. But, you know, if you take that, if you do believe that he had a role in it, then what's next? Then you think, okay, this is a family that was, by all accounts, really tight-knit. Did they all know about this? And it's a bit of a black box, right? I think that there may be a time down the line, if this case enters another phase, which it potentially could, where we start to get into that a little bit, and you can hear a little bit of the dynamic in the tapped phone calls that we play in episodes 5 and 6. You can see a little bit into that world, but that was by far the biggest challenge because obviously the Adelsons were not going to speak to us except for Rob and except for Wendy very briefly. But we found ourselves struggling to reconcile, you know, my way into the case was through Dan's friends, right? So we were well stocked on people who could speak about Dan, but we also wanted people who could speak about Wendy and her family. And that was and continues to be a challenge.
So you did eventually at least speak a little bit to Wendy, and we actually, here's a question actually for one of your producers, Marshall Louie. He's the executive producer on the show. So you were actually the one to conduct the interview with Wendy that comes towards the end of the show. How did that even come about?
So we had a lot of trouble early on really getting inside the Adelson family. They're obviously really under lockdown right now. The trial's coming up. And I started, like any good producer, stalking her on social media.
Is that what you do?
It's one of the tools.
I've always wondered.
Yeah. And so I found her Instagram account. It was a private account. I friend requested her and she accepted my friend request, which surprised me.
Yeah.
And this all happened over Christmas. So this was like December 28th or 29th or something. And I spoke with my other producer, George Lavender, and spoke with Matt and Eric about this. And, you know, obviously didn't want to be lurking in her social media account as a journalist for very long. So within like 12 hours, I sent her an email saying who I was, what I was doing, why I had friended her, and to thank her. And I should mention, we did have some friends in common, which is another thing. But I decided instead of trying to go through one of them, I would just reach out to her directly.
May I ask, by the way, if you had friends in common, were you aware of this story then even before you started producing?
I never was. But one thing that's been interesting about Dan and Wendy is that they both just seem to have a big social circle, both of them. So Dan Markell, which is kind of covered in the podcast, knew lots of people and lots of people knew him. And I had friends who had gone to law school with him, who I knew and spoke to about Dan. But I didn't know the story before Matt brought it to us.
So how did you prepare for this interview? That is, at that point, you must have been aware that this could be, you know, a climactic moment in the show.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of surprised that she would answer. She emailed me back. We made a plan to talk. We started texting. Again, this was all over the holidays. So it was on December 31st, we got on the phone. And one of the things that was interesting was she made a big deal that she would be with her boys and that she had to step away from her boys and she couldn't talk very long. And even though we ended up talking for about a half an hour.
What was your impression of her?
I really enjoyed speaking to her. She, like everybody said, she was very charming. The funny thing was, and I said, thank you for accepting my friend request. And she said, well, I actually have, so my name is Marshall Louie. She said, I actually have a cousin with a very similar name. So I thought you were my cousin when you friend requested me. And so that's why I accepted your request, which I thought was funny.
But what do you think makes sense about her accepting the interview? Because, I mean, what does she have to gain, I guess, at this point of doing interviews?
It was a preliminary conversation, but it was not off the record. So it was a preliminary conversation that we had. We got into it in detail. And then it was a conversation about whether she was going to sit for a recorded interview.
And that did not happen.
We would have had a million things to ask her. You know, we could have kept her on the phone for 5 hours asking questions. And, you know, I think the immediate short term thought is, you know, what can we get her to cooperate at all? Does she want to tell any of her story or not? And then you start thinking about what you would ask her. So I think we were in sort of this limbo where Marsha was talking to her a little bit and communicating, and we're thinking, well, maybe this might actually be possible. And that, you know, I think we would have moved on to the next phase where we would have prepared actual questions. But, you know, the lawyer pretty quickly put the kibosh on that.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, we have a list of people that someday we hope we will be able to speak to. Wendy is obviously at the top of that list. And I hope she does tell her story. I actually get the feeling that she probably will. I think what you can get out of the writing workshop that she did and comments that she's made since, that she does feel like she's been, and comments that she made to Marsha, that she does feel like she's been maligned, that her side of the story hasn't been told, and that she does want to get it out there in a way that she can control it, because, you know, she hasn't been able to control any of her own story in any real way. It's been very much driven by law enforcement and prosecutors. So, yeah, I mean, look, I hope someday we do get to that point. And we might, you know, we might eventually get there. I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
There's been a lot of speculation, even in your show, about whether Wendy knew, what she knew, when she knew, what she knows now. What, personally, with your very limited contact with her, what do you think?
I don't know. I go back and forth. It's something I think about, I've thought about since the beginning, right? I mean, I think that we had this conversation with Georgia Kappelman, who's the prosecutor on the case, and we brought up, you know, the Wendy's reaction to Dan's death in the interrogation room, and obviously extremely forceful, right? Really sobbing. So we said, I remember this conversation very vividly with Georgia, and we said, what did you think? How could somebody have a reaction like this if they weren't learning about the murder for the first time? And Georgia's reaction was, yes, I understand what you're saying, but there are some people in law enforcement who think the opposite, that it was intentionally, that it was a forced performance, and that it was the performance of someone who was acting.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think, personally, that kind of, her reaction could not have not been genuine in some way. I mean, who knows? I've never met Wendy. I've never spoken to her directly, but it's a visceral, really wrenching reaction to the news.
You know, what she said to me was, I am a bystander, you know, and I have nothing to do with this. I have nothing to hide. And I think there are certain things that she said and did across the times where she did speak in public or in that interview, which was, you know, not public, but became public, that she was extremely surprisingly forthcoming about things. So if she knew what was going to happen, it kind of would be hard to imagine she would say some of those things.
It's an interesting thing. I once interviewed Andrew Jarecki, the guy who, you know, very famous documentarian of true crime. And the thing that he would tell his editors is, it can be both things. You can really love somebody and also want to kill them. You can be somebody who feels terrible that somebody has died and also be the person that pulled the trigger. I think that's maybe one of the reasons why true crime is so interesting, is that it forces us to like actually have to look at people and go like, I may not be getting what I'm seeing, you know? That's not a question, I guess, but I mean, do you feel that? After having gone through this story, do you maybe look at people differently?
That's really interesting. I need to think about that one. Where the story goes and how it unfolded and what was motivating the people behind it, I still have lots of questions about why they would think, if what seems to have happened, that they would be entitled to just sort of make this problem go away. Seems odd to me still.
Odd's a word.
Odd is an understatement.
Marshall, I know you have to go, but we're going to keep talking to Matt. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you.
you'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
If you're enjoying this series and would like to listen to the rest of Over My Dead Body ad-free, join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app. With a Wondery Plus subscription, you can listen to hundreds of Wondery podcasts all ad-free and get access to loads of bonus episodes and content, like the two bonus episodes of Over My Dead Body Season 1 about the Prodfather. Days before his murder, Dan Markle joined the legal team representing one of the rabbis facing charges, and it was while working on a story about the Prodfather that journalist Matt Scheer first heard about Dan Markle's murder. To access these bonus episodes and listen ad-free, join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.
The show makes, I think, a convincing case that the Adelson family was involved in this crime, at least somehow. At the end, Dan's friend, the attorney, Mr. Latt, kind of grudgingly gives one not-so-likely counter theory that the killers kind of did it on their own to curry favor with the Adelsons. What other theories have you been hearing? Anything plausible?
This is what's so remarkable about this aspect of the case. You know, you can grill people over and over again. Give me a plausible theory. Give me one explanation. People cannot come up with anything. You have a situation. Part of the reason they can't come up with anything is you have a situation where these two gentlemen from South Florida, one who's confessed to the crime, drove up to Tallahassee to murder someone who they had absolutely no connection to, except one connection, right? So if they didn't have, it's not like they didn't rob Dan, right? He wasn't robbed. They didn't go into his house. They didn't steal his computer. They killed him, allegedly. One of them allegedly. One of them confessed to killing Dan. And then they drove back. So it's, you know, there isn't another plausible theory that doesn't involve some sort of supernatural Martians landing aspect. At least I'm not creative enough to come up with one. The explanation that Latt hints at is the only one that could conceivably make sense, which is that let's say that Rivera and Garcia and Katie had decided that this was potentially a way to make money or to get the Adelsons to give them money down the line. And they did this because they knew the Adelsons wanted it done. Now, there are a lot of reasons why that makes no sense, but it's at least within the realm of possibility, I suppose. I mean, why you hear Dave in that last little bit sounds so, you know, grudgingly, you know, with the maybe is because, you know, I really pushed him on it. I was like, can you give me anything like that makes sense? But look, one thing we should point out here is that the defense is under no obligation to or lawyers for the Adelsons are under no obligation to present plausible alternative theories. Legally, all they have to do is say that there's no evidence that connects the Adelson family directly to Luis Rivera and that there is reasonable doubt. That's all they have to do. So, you know, we can come up with these theories, as ridiculous as they may or may not be, but at the end of the day, that won't happen in the courtroom. There's not going to be an airing of the alternative theories. It's going to be a matter of poking enough holes in Rivera's story to discredit him. Then I think in an ideal circumstance for Sigfredo Garcia and Katie Magbanua, they poke enough holes in Rivera's story that maybe they get off for the crime, right? Maybe they're found not guilty because there's enough reasonable doubt. And then it all ends, right? Like if they don't go to jail, if they don't get convicted, this is over. It's a really remarkably unusual situation that everyone has found themselves in.
Well, sure. And I mean, something else unusual about the case that's pointed out by one of the other characters is that there have been plenty of cases that have gone to trial with far less circumstantial evidence. And you lay out, again, a number of possible explanations for why the state prosecutors haven't charged Charlie or any of the other Adelsons. But how about you personally? Like, what do you think? Are the state prosecutors just afraid of taking on a well-connected family? Is this just Florida? What's going on?
I think this is the by far the next big step of the investigation, right? This is where, if we ever did a series of follow-ups to this show, where we would go, and we would really dig into what exactly happened inside the prosecutor's office and what exactly happened with law enforcement in the decision-making process, because it is not readily explicable how this went down, right? As you mentioned, there's we interview someone who had worked in the prosecutor's office before and says, you know, of course we tried cases with the same amount of circumstantial evidence and we got convictions. I think my sense of what happened is twofold. I think that if there is a link between the Adelsons and Katie and Sigfredo and Louis, Louis Rivera, direct link, it's just the investigators haven't been able to find it. There's no smoking gun. And that I think there is a real fear of messing it up, right? I mean, you think about cases that have not resulted in successful convictions. And as we say at the end, you only get one shot. I think there is, I wouldn't call it a fear on the prosecutor's part. I would just call it a real sense of carefulness. And but outside of the fact that the family, the Adelsons, are wealthy, you have the fact that this is a high profile case now and has been for years. And let's say you botch it, right? Let's say you take it to trial and you charge additional people and it all goes to hell. It's a mess, right? I mean, I think that, yeah.
But really quickly, why at least wouldn't they take Charlie Adelson, the dentist, why wouldn't they at least bring him in for questioning or something? That's something actually a lot of people from social media have asked. It seems like can't you just talk to the guy?
You could try, but he doesn't have to talk, right? I think this is a part of the investigation that we don't fully understand yet. And I think that there are, that we might understand further in coming years. But you take Wendy, for example. She agreed to that first interview where she went in and they notified her that Dan was dead. And then after that, she stopped talking, right? They have really good lawyers. And those lawyers for Wendy and her brother and their parents have said, we're not going to make our clients available. We don't want them to talk. And as long as they can keep that up, you know, it will take something big cracking in the case, right? The most plausible outcome that people seem to think could happen is eventually, faced with life in prison, Katie Magbanawar and Sigfredo Garcia decide to say what they know, if they know anything more. But so far that moment hasn't come, right? And we would think that it would have already come. It's not like there's, you know, they've already been charged, right? They're already in jail. So, it's very puzzling, that part of it. And yeah.
All right. We're still waiting for that classic detective story ending. Matt, thank you for taking all my questions. That's all I got. I'm really interested to see where this story is going to go.
You're welcome, Rico. Thanks for listening. And by the way, folks, definitely check out Rico's two podcasts, Safe for Work and a new show called One Plus One, that brings to life the stories of history's great creative partnerships, starting with John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
Yes, maybe everybody out there can refresh their palate with a story about a partnership that maybe had a little bit more creative and productive output than this particular one.
Sounds good. I'll check that out. Talk soon, Rico.
Thanks.
And we'll continue to provide updates on the story as it develops. We'll also keep you posted on the latest legal thinking about the case.
There's, I think, sufficient evidence to charge all three of the Adelsons, but the fact that they're not bringing charges yet is, my intuition is, they want to have a slam dunk before they go against those heavy hitters.
That's from a bonus interview, available only for Wondery Plus subscribers. We talked to a legal expert who's been following the Markell case about murder-for-hire investigations and whether we're likely to see more charges filed. To listen to it now, as well as your favorite Wondery originals ad-free, subscribe to Wondery Plus. Go to wondery.com/plus. That's wondery.com/PLUS. You'll find a link in the episode notes. Thank you to everyone who's already subscribed. We'll continue to post more bonus materials there. From Wondery, this is a special episode of Over My Dead Body. If you have a tip about a story involving two people pushed to their limits that could be the next season of Over My Dead Body, email us at tips@wondery.com. That's tips@wondery.com. If you'd like to help us spread the word, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and every major listening app, as well as on Wondery.com. This episode was produced by Katie Long, mixed by Marcelino Villalpando. Over My Dead Body is executive produced by George Lavender, Marshall Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Over My Dead Body ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.